He's a huge part of NAVA, and he's touched so many people's lives, and I'm just taking his ego right on up. So with that, I'll give you Bob.
My name is Bob Meadows, and I'm an alcoholic. My first sponsor required me to always wear a coat and tie when I went to speak. And that was out of respect for y'all and out of respect for myself. So I still do that to this day. How many people in the room tonight, and I only do this so to make sure that I'm in the right place. How many people kept on drinking after you were already drunk? Well, I'm in the right place one more time. And Alcoholics Anonymous has been very, very good to me in my life. And I'm going to tell you a little bit of my story, a little bit of my life, and share with you. In the book, it says what I was like, what happened, and what I'm trying to be like today. It doesn't say what it was. It says what I was. And also, it says in the book about the adventures before and after. And I can assure you, I've had adventures before and after. I'm a rarity. Not a rarity, a rarity. I'm a native Atlanta. I was born in Crawford Long Hospital on March the 7th, 1946. And for you mathematicians out there, that makes me 62 years old, which is about 41 years longer than they gave me to live. So, I took my first drink at the age of 7, and I took my last one at the age of 36. And I drank all my life. I drank all my life. I don't remember a time when I didn't drink. Now, you think it's hard to get drinks when you're 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 year old. It is, but you can do it. I can assure you. I have done it. I took that beer that time at the old Ponce de Leon ballpark. Now, at that time, that was the home of the Atlanta Crackers, the baseball team. I was out in the bleachers with my father, and we were out there, and he was betting on flies and tips and that kind of stuff, doing a little gambling. And I would later on do that same thing many, many times. But I run around and drank those beers, and it did something for me that it was to remain with me for a long, long time. It changed me. I'm not one of those people that will tell you that they had any fun drinks. When I was sober about 3 years, I came to the conclusion that I never had a fun drink in my life. I had a lot of drinks, but I didn't have any fun drinks. Because I knew even at that time, even at that earlier age, that if I had to drink in order to fit in, there was something wrong with me. So I never had any fun drinks. I drank a lot, and I would have told you I had fun drinks in grammar school. I'd have told you I had fun drinks in high school. I'd have told you I had fun drinks in the Army. I'd have told you I had fun drinks in college. And I'd have told you I just had fun drinks. It's not true. I never had a fun drink. At 5 years of sobriety, I finally told somebody else that, too. I finally admitted to that fact. I grew up on the south side of Atlanta. I was born in Cabbage Town, which is on the south side of Atlanta. I grew up on the wrong side of the tracks in Cabbage Town, Grant Park, and Capitol Homes. So I'm not only a survivor of alcoholism, I'm a survivor, period. I have some scars to prove it. I went to public schools here in Atlanta. I went to grammar school at Hope Smith High School, at Ed S. Cook Grammar School. I went to Roosevelt and Hope Smith High School. I had a pretty good education, a pretty good time in school. The first time that I ever got rip-roaring drunk, I was between the 9th and 10th grade on summer vacation. At that point in time in my life completely changed. I went from being a very good student, a very, very good student, to being just finally going down the hill to just barely making it to graduate from high school. Now, I've had many people in my life that were good people, mighty fine people. I was taught the difference between right and wrong, and I always knew the difference between right and wrong. Always. I had people in my life that were good role models. I had uncles, aunts, mother, everybody. Now, my father, if he was an alcoholic, and I fully believe that he was, he was the one that allowed me to drink at first. But my father died when he was 57 years old, and he died from alcoholism. He died in Reedsville Prison, which is the toughest prison in the city and in the state of Georgia. And whatever he may have done, I can tell you I far surpassed anything he ever thought about doing. And so life was up and down for me. When I was 17 years old, I had my first business. I was still a junior in high school, and I had been on the streets. I was undisciplined. I just didn't listen. I just wouldn't do anything people wanted me to do. I did what I wanted to do, when I wanted to do it, where I wanted to do it, and how I wanted to do it. But I had some good quality points in there, too, because I had been working for the Atlanta newspapers for a long time, and even at that time. So I had a good distributorship for them, and I was making some good money. So at 17, 18, and 19 years old, I made more money than I did later on in life. And so I had that distributorship. Long about that time, too, I met my high school sweetheart, and we were to marry later on. And so things were going good in life, except for one thing. I was just drinking myself to death, even at that young of age, and I drank all the time. But when you're 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, you can drink all the time and work 18 hours a day, which is what I was doing. And I couldn't do it today. I don't know how I did it then, but I couldn't do it today. But the thing is, I was able to do that then. When I was 20 years old, I got drafted into the Army. I went into the Army in 1966, at the height of the Vietnam War. And the Army was a good place for me. That is the second place in my life where I almost fit in. I almost fit in the service. I enjoyed the structure. I enjoyed the discipline. I enjoyed the camaraderie, everything. I enjoyed the whole thing. The only problem was I kept drinking. But I enjoyed it. The only other place I've ever fit in my life is right here. This is the only place I've ever actually fit in completely. It's right here. But I almost fit in the service. And I was a pretty good soldier. I did what I was told to do most of the time. I also did what I had to do most of the time. In other words, I was a good soldier. In fact, I was a pretty good soldier enough that in 1967, I was voted and passed and all this other good stuff to be MDW Soldier of the Year in 1967, which is Military District of Washington Soldier of the Year in 1967. And that was a very honor and a very privilege to have that. So I came back from the service, and my wife and I, by that time we were married, we had one child. Came back from the service, came back to Atlanta, and came back to work for the greatest enabler business that I'd ever had. I went back to work for Atlanta newspapers, and I worked for them off and on. Now, I have never been fired from a job. I have never been in jail, never been in prison, or any of that stuff until I backed somebody into a corner, and they didn't have any choice in the matter. And that happened to me several times, many times too many. So the newspaper kept shifting me from department to department. And they were the greatest enablers in any business I've ever been in. The only thing was that finally, after a period of time, even they couldn't do it anymore. So finally, when I backed them into the final quarter, they had to do something about it. So they finally had to fire me. But in the meantime, there was about a two-year period there when I had eight DUIs over an 18-month span. I went to prison. I came out of prison after about three months or something like that. And the newspaper took me back in because they had gotten me out. They had went to bat for me one more time. And then I repaid them by doing exactly the same things I'd always done. What I wanted to do, when I wanted to do it, where I wanted to do it, no matter what it cost. It just didn't matter. I was that selfish and self-centered individual. From there, times just got worse as far as the marriage went and other things went. It just kept getting worse and worse. And then finally it got worse. Now, if you don't believe that the word is worse, believe me, there is. So I went to work in the printing business. And I got this job. It was something that I had never done before, had no earthly idea what to do. A neighbor of mine got me to work in the printing business, and this was what I did. And then I found this out in my fifth step. I found out in the fifth step that what I did all of my life was is that I would work or whatever I had to do to get within the pinnacle of success of whatever I wanted to do, especially if it's something that interested me to no end, then I could do it until I got the pinnacle of success within grasp, and then I would shoot myself out of the saddle. And I did that over and over and over again and never recognized it. I never knew it. Went to work in the printing business, did real well. I became one of five men in the whole plant that could run the rolls on five different presses that could keep them running 24 hours a day. And again, I was doing well. Everything was fine. Should have been fine except for one thing. I continued to drink and do the things that I wanted to do when I wanted to do them, no matter the fact that I had a wife and kids at home. I just didn't pay any attention to them. When that year was almost up again, I was out doing some things I shouldn't have been doing with people I never should have been with and doing in places I never should have been, and I wound up in prison again. And so this time, it was a few more months, and this time I finally got out. I came out. And sometimes, you know, you go up the ladder, and sometimes you go down the ladder. Well, this time I went up the ladder. I came out and went to work for Westinghouse. How I got the job, I just went and applied for it. Didn't know anything about it, just went and applied for it. It was an administrative job, and at the end of 1 year, I went up the ladder and was administrative assistant to the man that managed the whole southeastern area from Westinghouse, and had went way up the ladder. It was going well. They gave me a vacation at that time, and this shows you how selfish and self-centered that people like me are. Most people, when they get a vacation, and they gave me this vacation, something I hadn't had enough time there, but they gave it to me because of the hard work I'd done. Again, it was something that I liked doing. It was something I was used to doing. It was dealing with people. So it was something I had to grasp in. And I really loved it. They gave me the vacation. And people with sound mind and sound judgment, when they have a wife and two kids, when they go on vacation, they take their wife and kids and go to Florida or something like that. I didn't do that. I went with some friends of mine and went to North Carolina and got drunk. And stayed drunk the whole time. Not only did I stay drunk the 1 week, I stayed drunk 2 weeks. And I came back fully expecting to have that job. Now that's insanity. That's insanity. The thing that had happened at that time was the man that had originally brought me the message of Alcoholics Anonymous was working in the clothing business. This man had brought me the message in 1969. Now, I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. He just brought me the message. He had called me right before that and asked me if I knew anybody that needed a job. And I told him I didn't know anybody. So when I got back to North Carolina, when I lost that job, I called him. And I said, "Bob, is that job still open?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Good." He said, "You found somebody?" I said, "Yeah, me." He said, "You got a good job." I said, "Not anymore." So I went to work in the clothing business. And that was in 1972, and I was to stay in that business until I retired in 2003. I spent 30-something years in it. The thing is that I still kept doing the same things over and over again, expecting different results, because in the meantime, again, I had wound up in prison for the third time. So the thing is that when you do things you're not supposed to be doing, with people you're not supposed to be with, and doing places that you're not supposed to be there, you know, you get in trouble and there are consequences to pay. And I paid those consequences over and over again. And I never thought anything about it. Never thought anything about it. I'll tell you what scared me. Scared me was GMHI, Georgia Regional, Fulton County Detox, places like that scared me. Prison didn't scare me. Jails didn't scare me. I could get out of them. I knew that. But I knew if I ever walked into one of these other places, I might not ever get out. They scared me. I went to work for a national chain. I went to work first in Atlanta with a small store here, and I went to work for a national chain. Went to work for a company out of New York. They had 61 stores all over the country. I started training in their stores. I trained in Anniston, Alabama, over in Jackson, Mississippi, and a couple of other places. Came back to Atlanta, and then they started sending me to different places. And then they made one huge mistake. They sent me to a store of my own to manage. Now, they sent a raging alcoholic to an alcoholic paradise. They sent me to Panama City, Florida. Now, this is perfectly acceptable in Panama City, Florida, when you're in the business down there. The business world, we all ate mostly at the same place. We all drank at the same place because we drank while we ate. And it was perfectly acceptable to have a 3-martini lunch. Now, my problem was that I was having drinks before lunch, drinks during lunch, and then drinks after lunch. And while all these other people were going back to their businesses, I was still sitting there. So even when your bosses are in New York, you know, sooner or later, you get caught. And I did. And I got called in 2 or 3 times. One of the road supervisors came in. And so for about the next 2 or 3 months, things went along pretty good. I acted pretty well proper. So I didn't want to lose that job. Besides that, I like living in Panama City. And so, but we lost the lease on that building down there, and so I had to come back to Atlanta. And this time they allowed me, or told me, that I was going to be a road supervisor for them, or an auditor. And so I started traveling for them. So I went all over the country. The only bad thing about that is I carried me every place I went. The good news is that I only had to stay in most of them 1 week, so I didn't get in too much trouble. I didn't have time to. In fact, from that time on, I never got in too much trouble after that. Not real trouble, anyway. Not what I had been getting into. The thing is that even then, you know, when you're not doing the things you're supposed to do, when you're not giving your employer the job that you're supposed to be giving him, and this kind of stuff, sooner or later, you're going to pay a price. Well, I paid the price. I kept getting worse and worse, physically sick. By this time, the alcohol didn't work. The marriage had been over with. Nothing worked. And I still continued to drink. I couldn't stop. I had no idea how to stop. I just continued to do it. I continued to have that selfish and self-centered individual that I was. I was no way out of it. I just continued to do the same things over and over again. But the company didn't learn anything. After that, for a while, they decided that they had a road supervisor at that time had been in retirement. He wanted to come back to work, so they put him back to work, and then they sent me to the second alcoholic paradise. They sent me to Pensacola, Florida. They didn't learn anything. Nothing. So the same thing started happening down there. So the only thing is, down there, I kept getting worse and worse. This time, sometimes I wouldn't show up to open the store. Sometimes I just wasn't there, period. Once I had to do a traveling job for him again on an emergency job, I had to go to Galveston, Texas. And so I flew into Galveston, stayed there 2 weeks, flew back. I was supposed to fly back. I had caught a plane in a shuttle flight into Houston, caught a plane in Houston to New Orleans instead of going to Atlanta, which you normally had to do. I caught the same plane 3 days later. 3 days I spent in New Orleans drunk instead of catching the same plane. I was supposed to have a 3-hour layover, and I could wait 3 days. Didn't even get fired. But sooner or later, even when you're, you know, when you're going to have to pay the price and the consequences, and I did. And so they checked me out of the store, and then I became a street drunk. And I stayed a couple of months down there, so I don't remember the exact dates. But then I became a street drunk. And I was just a gutter street drunk. Didn't have a place to live. Had some other little things I could do. You know, I was a pretty good burglar. And I could do things like that and make a dollar or two here. And I was I'd been a hustler all my life, one way or the other. I could make a few dollars doing this. So I didn't starve to death, but I did live on the street for a long time. And finally, I did the one thing that I hadn't wanted to do. I had to call the greatest enabler in the world. I called Mama. Always you can call Mama. So I called my mother and my sister, and they sent me some money to catch a bus back to Atlanta. And I promptly got drunk, stayed drunk for a week, didn't come back. And so then, after a while, I had to call them again. And this time, they learned something. They were pretty smart. They sent me a ticket. So I came back to Atlanta and decided that what my problem was is I didn't have enough education. So I decided to go back to college on the GI Bill. Now, I have to tell you the truth about this is the reason I went back on the GI Bill is so I could get that check every month. I didn't go back to learn anything. But I did. I did well in school. But when I came back, I had to take full courses during the night and the daytimes. And I also worked during the day. What had happened also is one of the other national chains had hired me. I went in the same industry for the other national chain. Now, they knew my history. They took me anyway. So I was working here in Atlanta. I was going to school full time. And things were rocking along. And at the end of about 18 months, and this story I have to tell because this is funny to me anyway, I had a psychiatry professor. And one day I got a note from one of the other classmates to come down to his office. And I was on the way down there, and I kept thinking to myself, oh, God, what have I done now? Because I had told people years before that, in a lot of situations, I told people, I don't want to know what I did. Don't tell me. I don't want to know. So I'm thinking, what did I do? I got into his office, and he looked at me, and he said, I don't understand you. And I said, you ought to be looking at it from my side. So what had happened was he was one of those professors that liked to grade on the curve. And he liked to grade on the curve. Well, it just so happens it was a human psychology class, and I had scored a 97.8 on it. Don't even remember taking the test. And he couldn't understand that. I couldn't either. But the thing is, it's just, I don't know why those things just worked for me, but they just always did. I was like a sponge. I could just absorb things and then use them. I mean, not just forget them, but use them in practical life. The thing I got out at school was that some years later, when I was able to buy my own business, those things come in handy because I majored in business management with a secondary in accounting. It was fit right in. And I also finished in the top 15% of the class. And we were all of us, a lot of us were just, all of us were, or not all of us, but most of us were a little bit older than normal college kids. And so we did real well in competition with them. So, again, things just kept getting worse and worse in my life. And I kept getting worse and worse in life. And the physical ailments kept getting worse and worse. And so in 1981, I took a trip. Oh, by the way, I got to say this, too. By the way, when I worked for the second company, I met the man that brought me the second message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and his name was Jason Thompson. And a lot of people in this room remember Jason. He brought me the second message of Alcoholics Anonymous. He brought it to me from 1976 to 1979. He 12-stepped me for 3 years. I still wouldn't come. And he still didn't get sober then until 79. We drank together. We did a lot of things together. And by that time, Bob Catlin had already gotten sober. So the thing is that the selfishness and self-centeredness of me and that just that rigorous way that I lived within my own self just kept getting worse and worse and worse. So I went down to visit Bob down in Tampa, Florida, and stayed down there a week with him. And I came back to Atlanta. And just before I left, when I was getting on the plane, I looked at Bob and I said, Bob, if I actually need any help, I'll come back down here and see if you can't help me. And he said, Bobby, they have good Alcoholics Anonymous in Atlanta. So I got on the plane. I came back to Atlanta. And by that time, I knew I was physically sick. And I was. My whole body was physically sick because I hadn't been to the doctor. I hadn't had a physical or anything since 1968. So when I got out of the service, and so I knew I was very, very badly sick. And finally, I had to submit to go to the doctor, and I went to our family doctor, and he gave me a complete physical, the whole complete works. And as we got through with it, I was sitting in his office, and he looked at me, and he said, Mr. Meadows, the very best I can tell you is that you're a walking dead man looking for a hole to fall in. Now, that was news. My blood pressure at that time was 190 over 120. No telling how long it had been that way. My internal organs were just, I mean, they were all messed up. My heart was palpitating. And he told me that, you know, I couldn't live any longer. That I had my body just couldn't stand it anymore. And then he asked me the question that no alcoholic will answer truthfully. At least I won't. He said, "How much do you drink?" I said, "Oh, I drink sociably." And he said, "Oh, well, you know, one or two, three beers a night won't hurt anybody." And I told him the half truth. You know, we're half honest. I said, "I don't particularly like beer." He said, "Well, what do you drink?" I said, "I drink blended whiskey." Now, I didn't tell him that I drank right good vodka, lemon extract, grain alcohol, anything that had alcohol in it, because you can strain it through bread and drink anything. We drank a lot of right good apple-made vodka-type stuff in prison. I can guarantee you it would knock the top of your head off. So we drank, I drank everything, but I didn't tell him the truth. And he said, "Okay." He said, so he gave me this medication. So he gave me some Librium. Because by that time, I was jerking because I was going into alcoholic convulsions. I was past DTs because I hadn't had a drink in 12 hours. And you see, if I didn't drink every 3 hours, I went into DTs. I had to drink every 3 hours. And I did that for many, many years. So he gave me the medication and told me under no circumstances do I drink any alcohol and take this medication. So he gave me three different types of medication. For my heart, for my blood pressure, and for the Librium for my nerves. Now, I didn't know anything about drugs, but I knew enough about them to know that they were supposed to make you feel better. So I went across the street to the drugstore. I took one of the heart pills, one of the blood pressure pills, and just to be on the safe side, I took two of the Libriums. And nothing happened. I got worse. It didn't help at all. I just got worse. So I took one more of the Librium. And then it got worse. And I got to a point at that point in time in that drugstore where I never, ever want to be again. I got to a point in time to where I was afraid I wasn't going to die. That is the loneliest place you can possibly be in life. I was just worried I was not going to die. But I perked up, left the drugstore, walked 2 blocks down the street, to the liquor store, walked in, got a pint of liquor, walked out, opened it on the way out, drank part of it down, and the magic elixir worked one more time. That's what my body needed. The medicine that he gave me would work for a normal person. I was not a normal person. It didn't work for me. But the booze did. Almost a year went by before finally I got to the point when a man asked me a question. I was in jail for the last time out in East Point. I had been living there for many years, been drinking in this little park out there for years, never bothered anybody, nobody ever bothered me. And one day, the police did, for some reason, I think it was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I wound up in East Point Jail one more time, and something happened that had never happened before. I wound up totally alone in the world. Nobody would come get me. Nobody. I was in there, and I was on my own, completely isolated from the world. I had driven everybody away. And that's where I always wanted to be. I had never wanted to have people in my life for years anyway. I wanted to be totally alone in the world. And I got there. And I didn't like it. I didn't like it. Finally, this friend of mine did come get me, Jimmy Lee. And he came to get me because we worked together. His dad had bought, the chain had went bankrupt. His dad had bought that store, so we were working together. And he came to get me. He was downstairs in the foyer of that little jail, and I came down, and this desk sergeant looked at me, and he looked at Jimmy, and he looked back at me, and he looked at Jimmy, and he said, "Do you want it?" And that's what I had become. I had become an it. I was not a person anymore. That's what I was. And he was right. That's what I was. I was an it. I wasn't a person. I hadn't been a decent person in years and years and years. And so Jimmy said, yeah, so he did. A few days later, when he decided to tell me, I didn't know that my mother and sister and my attorney. Now, I didn't go anywhere without my attorney. I can assure you of that. I learned that a long time ago. And the good news was is my attorney was also my cousin. So blood is thicker than water, too. Our money. So the thing is that Jimmy told me, he said, if you ever want to see about getting some help, he said, I'll make sure that your job is still here if you want to go see about getting some help. And I had a moment of clarity. I don't know why or how, But I thought about it and thought about it, and I said, okay. And he said, well, your attorney knows this place, or you know this place too. And so I went out to the VA hospital out here on Claremont Road to see about getting in for A&D unit. And so while I was there, still being very defiant, as most alcoholics are, when they told me it was a six-week program, nope, I ain't doing that. So right after we got through with the interview, two things had happened. There was two doctors and a nurse at that interview. And those two doctors were both in recovery. They were both recovering alcoholics and addicts. And this, I swear, I thought at the time, I really thought at the time that these guys had talked to my lawyer and my mother and sister and had gotten some lowdown on me that they couldn't have got anywhere else. Now, you know, confidential information by law, it's just not transferable like that. But I thought that. The truth of the matter was, is they knew how I had felt. They knew some of the things I had done because they had done the same things. And it was amazing to me. So after we were getting ready to leave, and I had decided I wasn't going to check into the hospital, Dr. Billy F. told me the magic words. I had told him about the fact I had known about Alcoholics Anonymous all those years, because by that time I had known about it for 13 years. I had just not come. In fact, the last 5 years before I came, I just fought coming. I wouldn't come. I just fought coming. And not that I didn't know a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous, or I didn't know that much, but I knew a lot about where it was. I knew where Helen was at the central office down on Spring Street. I knew where the NABA Club was here. I knew where the Terra Club was out in Hateville. And I knew where the old Dogwood Club was down across the street from Manuel's. Now, people that don't have an alcohol problem don't have that much knowledge of those kind of things. Don't have any need to. So, anyway, I decided to go in for a week. And I went into a week for detox. And I got sober in this clubhouse. And I went into I went in on May the 5th, 1982. And I haven't had a drink since then. I drank my last drink in the parking lot of that hospital, finishing up that bottle before I low crawled into the bushes, coming into the hospital. I didn't give up till the last minute. That's what I was like, and that's pretty much what happened to me. And now I'm going to try to share with you some of what I'm trying to be like today. It also talks about, in how it works, it talks about your adventures before and after. And I'm going to tell you some of the adventures I've had before and after. The adventures that I've had before and after in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I'm a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that. I fully believe that I'm a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the only thing that has ever worked in my life. Nothing else. Not, quote, the proper schooling, and I had that. Not, quote, the proper religious training, and I had that in two religions, not in one. Never worked. The only thing that's ever worked is right here. The only thing that's ever worked in my life is those 12 steps of recovery, the traditions, and trying to live by the principles and having new people in my life. That's the only thing that has ever worked. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was not agnostic or anything. I just practiced agnosticism, which I didn't care one way or the other where there was a God. Didn't matter to me. I didn't ask God for any help when I was out there. I had long, for many years, quit asking Him for foxhole prayers and that kind of stuff. I just didn't do it. I knew that if any trouble I was in, any situation that I was in, the cause of that situation was me. And it was up to me to get myself out of it. So I never asked for any foxhole prayers. I came here, and when I stopped drinking, things got better right off the bat. I mean, I didn't get any better, but things got better. What happened was I started having a little money in my pocket. I was able to do a better job. I was able to do things with family again. But what happened was that I didn't get any better until I started finally working the 12 steps in recovery. I had about 18 months in the program before I finally did a 4-step. What I did was I laid the foundation for my recovery in steps 1, 2, and 3, as it talks about. And I found a little bit of a faith, just enough faith to leap forward to do the rest of the steps. Now, I still didn't have a real faith in God, but I had a real faith in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had a real faith in the people. So it worked very well for me. My first sponsor, when we were going through the steps, he told me when we were working the steps, when he taught me about the first step, that I'm powerless over alcohol and my life's unmanageable because I'm an alcoholic. It's just that simple. Nothing, there's no rocket scientist about that. When we're dealing with the second step, we got to the second step, and he told me, the only two things you need to know about God is, one, there is one. Two, you ain't him. We never had that conversation anymore. Ended that conversation. And he said, the third step is you make a decision. That's all you do. You make the decision to go on to the rest of the steps. And that's all we did. I made the decision to go on to the rest of the steps. And then I did steps 4 through 9. And I did the written inventory. And then I shared it with my sponsor and God and myself. And I found out the things that I had done all my life. I found out the patterns in my life. And then I found out how to correct those patterns in 6 and 7. And then I got to 8 and 9. And I made a list of the people I had harmed. And my sponsor required of me, when I made the list of these people, and then I wrote out what my part in all this was, that when I went to make amends to people, that I made those amends directly to these people. There wasn't no telephone calls, and I don't do computers either, so there wasn't no emails. None of that stuff. It was directly. I had to go directly to make the amends to these people. And that was required of me, and that's what I had to do. When I got through with step 9, or the biggest portion of step 9, it took me a long time to do the last two major amends. I was 13 years sober before I got to the last two major amends in my sobriety, the amends I had to make. But I made all the amends in the next couple of 3 years. I also had a lot of doing things that I hadn't done. I didn't know anything about sins of omission. I knew about sins of commission. But I didn't know anything about sins of omission. I learned about sins of omission in the 8th step. I didn't learn that till then. I had no idea about that until I learned it in the 8th step. And so I finished up with those, and the most relief I've ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous is when I finished the 9th step. Because by this time now, and today, nobody has any power over me anymore. And people had all the power in the world over me when I came here. I had that fear, resentments, and mostly the fear of people getting to know me or knowing what I was doing or knowing how I really was. And I don't have that anymore. And I don't have any problem with anybody anymore because I can walk down the streets of Atlanta or any other town I've ever been in, and I no longer have to cross the street when I see people coming. I don't have to duck in any more doorways if I see people coming. I don't have to duck in any alleys if I see people coming anymore. And what's more important to me is neither do they when they see me coming. That's more important today. You know, when I finally was sober a long time, I had met a young lady in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we had become friends. And we had been friends for a long time. And one Christmas morning, in this very clubhouse right here in the parking lot, when we were going out to the car together, we looked in each other's eyes, and we decided we wanted to be more than friends. We'd never had a date. Never had a date. But we decided we wanted to just be more than friends. And we were. From that point in 1986 till she got killed in a car wreck in 1999, we were inseparable. We went to meetings together. We did everything together. We got married in 1988. And I had been adamant about not having any more children because I already had the two. And that's all she ever wanted in life was a child. So we agreed to have it. So, 1991, we had our first son, Jimmy. He was born. He was born and he died in the same day. He was too small. We lost two more just miscarriages after that. In 1994, David was born. He was a full-term baby. He had a stroke the day before he was born. We had to take him off of life support 6 days later. And that almost killed both of us. We lost one more little boy after that in 1995. So we lost three children. And it was just devastating to us, both of us. Just absolutely devastating. And now, while I didn't get completely mad at God during that period of time, I kept doing the same things that I had always been doing. I kept having prayer and meditation, going to meetings, working with a sponsor, working with other people. I've had the privilege and pleasure of doing a lot of service work since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to be able to do service work at the VA hospital for about 10 and a half years. And so I had the greatest thing in the world that happened to me over there. I learned how to unconditionally love people. I learned how to give of myself and not expecting anything in return. Because I can assure you, I had a bad motive in my life for everything. So the thing is, I got to do a lot of service work, and like I said, we lost that last child, and in 1999 or 1995, my first sponsor died. My best friend in AA died in 1999. My wife got killed in that horrible car wreck. 2001, my baby sister died of a brain aneurysm. 2003, my mother died. So I had 12 years from 1991 to 2003, to where all I had was just grief, 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 just loss, loss, loss. And I did everything right. I went to meetings. I didn't drink. I called a sponsor. I did all the things right, and I almost died from it. And I had to go seek some professional help. And I did. I went to seek some professional help. And it helped me immensely, along with an Alcoholics Anonymous. It got me through it. Finally, I was able to start grieving. I hadn't had time to grieve anything. I just kept getting hit, just one thing after another. In January of this year, January the 14th, I came home from this very clubhouse from the 11 o'clock meeting, and I went home. I was going to fix lunch, and my arm started tingling, and I thought I was having a stroke. So I had some people working on my house at that time, and I asked them to call 911 for me, and so they did. By the time the EMT people got to my home, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know where I was. I had no idea what was wrong with me. I couldn't tell them any information or nothing. They got me to the hospital, I guess, 4.5 days later. And those 4.5 days are gone. They're not even a memory. I don't know what happened during that 4.5 days. Sherry might know. She was there. I don't know what happened, other than the fact that I woke up on that Thursday afternoon, and the surgeon is telling me I had just had major brain surgery, and I had the worst form of brain cancer that you can have. And that's something to wake up to. So the thing is that, you know, I've only had to do two things about this, just like I've done all the time. I keep having prayer and meditation. I keep coming to meetings. I keep talking with you people. I keep showing up here, and they find things for me to do. And all I have to do is what the doctors tell me to do and leave the results up to God. That's what I've always done. I don't have to do anything different today than I did then. Alcoholics Anonymous has been very, very good to me. It allowed me to work out in life. It allowed me to get into the own business that I worked in for several years. I finally bought that business. I had it for about 12 years. I was able to retire at 57 years old. So materialistically, I did very well. But I have done well in Alcoholics Anonymous because I am a product of it. And I have done the things I was supposed to do, for the most part. And I'm still about half honest. So the thing is that it has allowed me to have a wonderful life. It allowed me to get back in touch with the people in my family. My first wife and I are better today than we've been in years and years and years. Much better than even when we were married. And we were married for several years. And she was my high school sweetheart. So the thing is that all these people in my life, I have so much more in my life today than I ever could have possibly had. Number one, I'd been dead by now. No question about that. And the thing is that if I ever decided to take another drink, the one thing that keeps me from doing that is I'd have to give up you people. And I'd just have to give up y'all. It's just not worth it to ever take another drink again to have to give up y'all. And again, it's been very, very good to me. And you know, sometimes if you don't drink and go to meetings and you belong to this clubhouse here, they may even elect you president. Sometimes they may do it three times. The only clown that's ever done that. So the thing is that if you work hard, you do what you're supposed to do, trust God, clean house, and work with others, Alcoholics Anonymous will work in your life. And the reason I know that is it talks about in Part C of how it works, that God could and would if he was sovereign. Well, I'm here to tell you that God can and will if you'll let him. Thank you.